Hi everyone, this is Donna Slater from the UK again. Today, rather than doing a sound-seeing tour, I thought I would talk a bit about myself, in particular my education here in the UK, my career and my hobbies. It will maybe be of interest to some of you and not so much to others. If it's not of interest to you, then, as I've said, please feel free to hit the delete key, fast forward, or whatever suits you. Okay, well, I was born in the north of England in 1966, and my parents very quickly realised that there was something wrong with my eyes. As I grew, they realised that I couldn't see at all and started looking round for some help. Now, in 1966-1967 in the UK, the sort of help that was on offer was, let's say, quite primitive. My parents were told to, quotes, send me away to a home, unquotes, that I might be able to make baskets when I grew up, and, other such things. Fortunately for me, my parents were made of quite stern stuff and basically decided that they were going to give me the best chance possible. So, when I was about 3 years old, they started looking round for the best education for me. At first, they were directed to schools in Liverpool, which, again, is in the north of England. But my parents really, well, they weren't too impressed, in all honesty. And then someone said, well, there's a school in Sheffield, in Yorkshire, and that school has just started a scheme whereby when blind children reach the age of 12, they can be integrated into mainstream education. Well, that really got my parents' interest. They were all for me leading as normal a life as possible. And so they decided to go and visit the school and see what was going on there. I vaguely remember my sister and I going with my parents to the school and meeting the headmaster there and finding the place a very big, daunting, frightening place at the age of three. My parents were really impressed though, and the headmaster explained to them that yes, there was a pilot scheme for integrating children into mainstream education, but that mainstream education was only available to children who were academically very bright and who were able to stand on their own two feet socially and give as good as they got in terms of the bullying that they might receive or whatever. From that day on, my parents commenced a very difficult and hard fight to get me to go to this school in Sheffield. The school was called Tapton Mount School. The local education authority, who were responsible for funding, basically did not want to send me there. They wanted me to go to a school in Liverpool. They wanted me to stay there as a boarder. And they refused point blank to give my parents any support at all if my parents decided to send me to Sheffield. Well, that didn't deter my parents, luckily for me. And at the age of five, I started school at Sheffield. My mum would take me there on a Sunday evening, and my parents would pick me up from there on a Friday after school. So I would stay there during the week, and I would spend my weekends at home with my family and my sister. Now, that may not seem too bad, but what you have to realise is that certainly initially, the trip took more or less 4 hours each way. So that meant that 2 days out of the week my mum was driving 8 hours per day to get me to and from school. The roads were really bad, and my sister was younger than I was, and so that really was quite hard on my sister. She had to spend time with my grandparents and with friends of the family while my mum and Dad took me to school, and then my mum picked me up from school. It obviously affected my mum and Dad's social life and their work life and everything like that. And as I say, the education authority just kept saying, oh, you know, you'll give up soon enough, we're not really wanting to support you. My mum carried on and we changed education authorities, and the new education authority actually were extremely supportive and gave my mum some funding to enable her to take me to and from school. They literally just covered the costs of the fuel. Obviously at the time I didn't know that all this was going on, and I just went away to school each week and thoroughly enjoyed myself. It was a real revelation to me to learn Braille. As soon as I could read, I wanted to read everything and anything, and I used to get very, very frustrated that there weren't enough Braille books around, especially when I made friends who were reading sort of mainstream books, and I couldn't get them. When I was at Tapton Mount School, there were about 80 children, and initially when I was there, we spent all our time with one teacher. So whoever class you were in was responsible for teaching you for all the subjects. We would have a PE time, and there would be various other lessons where we might go to different teachers, but generally we would spend all our time with one teacher. In the evenings we slept in large dormitories, and one of the highlights at that school was bath time. Now, yeah, a lot of kids hate bath time, but at Tapton Mount School, the baths were down in an old stone cellar. And in this stone cellar, there were four baths and four showers. And on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I believe it was, the girls would have bath night, and Mondays and Wednesdays would be the boys' bath nights. Well, we used to love it because basically there was no restriction on how we emptied the baths. Yeah, okay, there was a conventional plug hole, but because it was a stone cellar and because it had drainage in the floor, we were allowed to empty the baths literally by splashing all the water out. Well, as you can imagine, kids, you know, between the age of sort of 5 and 10 absolutely loved being able to do that. The school did what it could at the time to integrate us into a, quotes, normal, unquotes, environment. So we would have children from other schools coming in for various lessons, and we would go to their schools for various lessons. This didn't happen a lot, but they did sort of make it happen as much as they could. Basically, as I say, I really enjoyed my time there, and I was very glad to have gone to a school for the blind, because I felt that they really equipped me with some basic skills that I needed to make my life very livable. I learnt to use the long cane and became a very competent user of the long cane, thanks to a wonderful mobility instructor called Doris Tews. I learnt some very basic cooking. I learned, well, obviously things like dressing, undressing myself, although my parents had done a pretty good job on that, I must admit. I learned to be able to make drinks and things like that. Now, at the end of my time at Tapton Mount School, the integration pilot scheme was still in place. And it was still very much the case that children with a very high academic record and who could mix very well socially were given the opportunity to attend a comprehensive school in Sheffield. This was a school with 1,500 children and probably at the most 14 blind children scattered throughout the school. What would happen was that the blind children would stay in a house about a mile from the school, and the house was looked after by house parents, so we got all our meals provided and all the basic necessities provided, and basically we all had a room each, or a room which we shared with one other person, and we would walk to school from there every morning and then return home there during the evening for evening meals and things like that. The school itself had a resource unit attached to it, basically a prefabricated cabin where the Braille machines, the Perkins and other equipment was stored. The unit was staffed by two resource teachers and one or two support technicians. The two resource teachers would go into any lesson with any of us where there was any sort of problem. Let's take a maths lesson, for example, where a lot of the work was written on the blackboard and was presented in maybe diagrammatic form. Then the resource teacher would come in and would help with ensuring that we got the maths down in Braille on our Perkins Braillers, and also would do some additional explaining if needs be. Or let's say we had a science lesson, a physics or a chemistry lesson. In chemistry, very often we were using Bunsen burners and boiling things in test tubes. Well, again, really the class teacher, when we had a class of 30, could not be expected to supervise one or two blind people. And so the resource teacher would come in and again would supervise us and would make sure that, you know, we didn't set the place on fire. As much as possible, though, we were encouraged to make friends and to rely on friends for, say, reading things off the blackboard to us, and for other generalised assistance that we might need. For me, this worked extremely well. I made a really good group of friends and I loved my time there, thoroughly enjoyed it, didn't really have many problems at all. It was probably one of the best periods of my life, I think. However, towards the end of my time there, policies changed and it was decided that really most people should be integrated into mainstream education. And what was happening was that even young blind children were being integrated into mainstream education, into first primary schools and junior schools. And also less academic children were being integrated into secondary schools. And so while I was at the secondary school, we had some children coming from Tapton Mount School who weren't as academically able and socially certainly had problems. And I unfortunately saw quite a lot of bullying occurring with regard to these children. And I saw that many of these children who were coming up into a, quotes, normal, unquotes, school were having huge problems. They weren't making friends, people were picking on them, people were doing atrocious things to them. I mean, really, kids can be so nasty. And the bullying was very, very bad for some of them. We all did what we could. We all tried to help, we tried to stamp out the bullying, but these kids were very, very unhappy. I can think of two in particular who went through a really awful time because it had been decided that they should be in mainstream education. Had they gone to a school for the blind, I think they would have had a lot better time. But, you know, the authorities and the powers that be basically felt that they would try and put everyone into mainstream education. When I was in the sixth form, I was encouraged to take the entrance exam for Cambridge University. And although I had grave doubts about this and really didn't think I would get in, I decided to take the exam and actually got a place at Cambridge University to study law. So after leaving school, I studied law for 3 years at Cambridge. I found my time there extremely hard work. I loved it, really enjoyed it. Again, I made a good group of friends, but the amount of work that was expected was extremely high. And basically, the way I had to work there, I would take a tape recorder into lectures and I would record the lectures. I would then return to my room and in Braille, on a VersaBraille, would write up the notes from my lectures. I would then do my research for essays by either having people reading extracts from law books to me or onto tape for me, or by using taped law books from the Royal National Institute for the Blind. Now, these taped law books were often very out of date because it's obviously very, very difficult to keep information up to date in a subject which moves as quickly as law. So I would read my out of date copy and then have to check with someone that, you know, what I was saying was correct or whether anything had changed. So I would take notes from these tapes and write my essay on the VersaBraille and then sit down in front of my typewriter and type my essay for the tutors to mark it. So effectively I was having to do twice as much work as anyone else. I should add that I was very, very fortunate enough to be one of the first people in Britain to have an opticon. The people in the village where I live actually clubbed together and raised the money for me to have an opticon because I was such a prolific reader. And so I did use that to a certain extent. In fact, I used the opticon an awful lot. But there was no way I could get through all my reading using an opticon. Well, I got my degree from Cambridge and I left Cambridge and then did my, what they called at the time, Law Society final exams at Manchester. This was a totally different environment. Basically, the law school was actually part of Manchester Polytechnic, or I think now that is now part of Manchester University. And I was in a hall of residence with a load of first years who weren't having to work very hard and who were going out every night on the town and then coming back and smashing the place up. So it wasn't very conducive to work. That year was an absolute struggle and I absolutely hated being there. It was a total and utter nightmare. The law course itself was really, really boring. I hated being in a hall of residence with first years, but I couldn't find any accommodation elsewhere. It was just a complete and utter nightmare. Following this, I worked for 3 years with a firm of solicitors, a firm of lawyers. I don't know exactly what your equivalent would be in America, I'm afraid. Now, this firm of solicitors was in a rural area, and so they did not have lawyers who specialised in one thing, which meant that I got a very broad experience. But because I was the only woman working with the firm of solicitors, I tended to get pushed into doing a lot of family law work, domestic violence, divorce, child abuse cases, all this sort of thing, which was extremely stressful and not very enjoyable. Also, during this period, I was meant to still be training. Someone was meant to be supervising me, but that actually didn't happen. And basically what happened was I was just getting more and more work. It culminated in me leaving the firm because I had been working literally every day for about 12 hours per day for the best part of 18 months with no time off, no free time, and I became ill. So the lesson learnt there was not to stress myself out too much over a job. I basically came to the view very quickly that there was more to life than working, and so I had maybe 8 months off work due to ill health, and I then worked within industry. The firm I worked for were a firm who built properties and they owned a large number of hotels and rented accommodation, houses, shops, etc., etc. And I was basically doing their legal work, so it's quite a change from what I had been doing. And initially, I enjoyed the job. It was very varied. I was quite often in court representing the firm in bad debt cases or in cases brought against the firm for negligence in building work or things like that. And my work was very varied. However, I soon discovered that the boss of the firm did not know the meaning of the word truth. And he was so bad that he would go into court and give the wrong date of birth and the wrong house address for himself. He could not tell the truth. And quite often he would go into court and he would completely change his story from the one which I had prepared, or, you know, which I had been given to prepare, which did not leave me looking or feeling very good. So after working there for just over 12 months, I moved down to Southampton to be nearer my partner, well, to be with my partner, and I took a master's degree in business law and information technology law at Southampton University. I loved doing that. It was really, really interesting. The internet was just sort of starting to become known about and vaguely important, and there was lots of discussion about what laws were going to affect it and how laws were going to affect it and how copyright and intellectual property rights would work, etc., etc. And the course I was doing, because we were so much specialising in that field, we were really on the cutting edge of that sort of area, the whole area with law regarding relating to the internet in the UK. Now, this time, my working method changed somewhat. I basically was very fortunate and managed to obtain a grant from the Guide Dog Association, actually, to allow me to buy a computer and a scanner, which meant that I could read all my own books, hooray! And I didn't have to braille and then type my work or anything like that. I could just put it straight on the computer. I still recorded my lectures because the VersaBraille had been returned to the local education authority because that had only been a loan item. And so all my lectures were recorded and I had to write those up when I got back. But really, that was no big deal. I didn't mind doing that too much. I thoroughly enjoyed my time at Southampton. As I said, the work was very interesting. I met interesting people there. My social life was very good. And so at the end of my master's degree, I stayed on and I did some lecturing in the area. And I absolutely loved doing that at university level. It was very interesting. I met some people there who were really challenging academically and kept me on my toes, and I just thoroughly enjoyed it. The university were also extremely helpful and extremely supportive, and basically tried to ensure that they gave me as much help with equipment, books, etc., etc., as I needed. They were by far my best employer. Well, after lecturing at Southampton, we moved back to the north of England, and basically my career has taken the back burner because I had a family and also suffered quite a lot of ill health. However, I did work on maternity cover at a local further education college teaching law. Now, that work was really interesting, and yes, I enjoyed it, but I very much felt that I was underachieving because I was having to spoon feed the people I was teaching. Because of the lady I'd taken over from, I was given no initiative in the way I taught, and so basically it was all through teaching via handouts and model essays, and there was no sort of, you know, think about it, question it, anything like that. You were just told exactly what you had to teach, and the students were told exactly what they had to learn. They didn't have to ask questions or anything like that. They were really spoon-fed. I also worked for a while as the clerk to the school governors, the school where my son and my daughter go to. Well, my daughter's at nursery there. Now, I don't know what the system is, again, in the US, but basically over here, schools are, quotes, managed, unquotes, by a group of governors, people within the community who have interest in the school, in theory, or who have management skills or educational skills. It's basically made up from different types of people within the community. As clerk to the school governors, I didn't have a say in any of the meetings. I took the minutes, distributed all the necessary information to all the governors, organised all the meetings and the subcommittee meetings, and did all the filing, ensured that they complied with all the legal requirements, informed them of any legal requirements, if there were any. This was all right, but not really my scene at all. I wanted much more input. So basically, last month I resigned from that position, having given them quite a lot of notice, and I'm now in the process of becoming a school governor and probably taking over the chairmanship, chairpersonship, chairwomanship of the governing body. I've never been a one for keeping quiet about things. I like to have my say, hopefully without being too obnoxious, but I basically feel I have a lot to contribute, and being the clerk just really wasn't the right position for me. That was a very, very part-time job. It was a job that I did just in the evenings when the children were in bed or when my husband was at home. And it didn't earn us much money at all, but it was just something that I really did to help the school out. Okay, so that's brought you up to the present, education and career-wise. But there are facts that I inadvertently missed out or that I've sort of glossed over, which I'll probably go back to in the future and give you more detail on if you want more detail. Now I want to talk about my personal life and my hobbies and my career in the future. Let's start off with my career in the future. My husband works away from home a lot. His job involves an awful lot of travelling, and yes, I am trying to get him to do some sound-seeing tours, but he's not very keen on the idea. I'll keep trying. So, he travels all over. He goes to Germany, Belize, Brunei, Canada, all over the place because of his work. When I worked temporarily at the Further Education College, Alex was at school, and so my work didn't really affect him because I was usually at home before he came home from school. And I went to work more or less as he went to school. But Bethany spent some time at playgroup, and then she spent time with my mum and Matt's mum, and one day a week with a childminder. Now, because of the sort of child Bethany is, she's quite a lot of hard work. I think my relatives sort of felt that it would be better for her to have more stability and more consistency, and I agreed. My working while she was sort of passed from one person to another really was affecting her quite badly. I am not condemning people for doing this. Please, please, please do not think that. I have close friends and my sister who've all had to return to work. I am just very, very, very fortunate that I haven't had to. So I am not condemning people for returning to work. All I am saying is that it did not suit us, and financially I didn't have to do it. So basically, I decided that I would wait until Bethany was a little bit older before I looked for any work that would take me out of the house. And this meant that I could be there to collect her from playgroup and to ensure she went to nursery, etc., etc. Well, in December last year, we moved house. It's a larger house with a better garden, it's better situated, and with all that, our mortgage has risen significantly. And we're still very, very reliant on just my husband's income. So we've been toying with various ideas for a while for me to go to work, etc., etc., but we still don't feel that it's right for the children at the moment. So I have been playing with ideas of starting my own business, and I've thought about various things. I've thought about legal consultancy, I thought about disability rights consultancy, using the internet as my main medium. I have done some market research in these areas and basically found that there are a lot of people providing a service similar to the one which I would be looking at providing. So we hadn't really come up with any ideas until a couple of weeks ago. I was scanning a mail order catalogue. Now, okay, everyone probably thinks, oh gosh, scanning a mail order catalogue, boring, haven't got time to do that. Well, I was scanning a mail order catalogue because I was looking for birthday presents for some people. And yes, I can go online and I can search online, but it's easier to look through a catalogue first and get your ideas together first and then do your online searches, I find, because if you're just searching about online, it can take absolutely ages, especially using a speech synthesiser. So I was scanning a catalogue and chatting to my son, who is 6 years old, and he basically said, oh, Mummy, why can't you just read that? And then he said, well, I know why you can't just read it, but wouldn't it be good if you could just read it? And I thought, yeah, he's absolutely right. It would be great if I could just read it. There are various mail order companies who are excellent, and they will provide their catalogues on cassette and occasionally on CD and occasionally a very, very cut down version in Braille. But there are hundreds and hundreds of mail order catalogue companies or internet companies who have catalogues. And the only way you can find out about them is going online and looking at their websites. Now, some of their websites aren't accessible, and really, generally, they don't just have like a catalogue of products. You've got to do a search around, or you've got to know roughly what you want to look at. You can't just sort of browse through a catalogue online and just find ideas. So Alex, my son's query and sort of thoughts got me thinking. And I started thinking how very, very fortunate I was to have the time to scan mail order catalogues and to be able to put them on my bookport and to look through them. Now, many blind people, or many print handicapped, print disabled people, sorry if I'm using the wrong terminology there, do not have the time, the money, the inclination, whatever, to scan these catalogues. And therefore, they don't have the ability to read these catalogues. I am aware that in the UK, and I believe in the US, there are transcription services who will transcribe material for companies at, well, quite a high cost. Obviously, these companies need to make enough money to make them really profitable. And these companies concentrate on accuracy, on presenting the information really well in a nice format. So I started to think, well, yes, that's all very well, but they're not transcribing catalogues. If they are transcribing catalogues, it's generally a cut-down version of a catalogue that's read onto cassette or that's put into Braille. And it's quite difficult to find the products within those catalogues. And also, you're not getting the full choice. You're just getting, you know, maybe sort of 25% of what is actually in the catalogue. I then started to think, well, what if I email the mail order catalogue companies and basically say that for a relatively small fee, and we're talking a lot less than transcribing things into Braille, for a relatively small fee, I would be prepared to scan their catalogue and distribute it as a text file via email or as an MP3 CD. We're using synthetic speech, or as a compilation of catalogues on CD in text format to any print handicapped person who wanted it. Now, I know to transcribe these catalogues in Braille and to ensure complete accuracy would cost a lot of money and time. That is not my aim. And I have specified that that is not my aim. My aim is to provide people with reasonable access to the catalogue information. For those companies who are, and I have got some who have already agreed, who are agreeing to pay a fairly nominal fee, I'm also offering for an extra fee to distribute their catalogues free of charge. Now, there are companies who refuse point blank to pay the distribution fee, in which case, to cover my costs, I am having to ask for a small fee from anyone who wants the catalogue. In terms of English money, I'm talking 75 pence per catalogue. That's per text catalogue. If it's on CD or if it's an MP3 catalogue, then the prices are slightly different. The reason I'm having to charge 75p is because I'm using PayPal and they charge for credit card transactions. So some companies are just paying me to produce their catalogue. They're not paying for any distribution. Other companies, well, forget it. They're not paying at all. They will send me a current copy of their catalogue and I can scan it if I want. Well, that's okay. That's fine. I'm not quibbling with that. I am not getting into the realms of arguing for access. I am trying to point out to companies that by giving blind and print handicapped people this sort of access, they will hopefully gain more customers. So in that sort of case, I'm still scanning the catalogues and I will still distribute them again at the same sort of charge, 75p per catalogue. Other companies very kindly are providing me with the PDF or even the text file of their catalogue, which is wonderful because it means that I can actually give out accurate copies of their catalogues. And they're paying me a smaller fee, again, for making sure that the catalogues are available in appropriate formats. So that's part of what I'm doing. Now, the other part is, because I quite enjoy trawling through catalogues, and, well, my husband has nicknamed me Inspector Gadget because I really do like new gadgets, new technology, new products. And everyone always says that I always come up with excellent presents for people. If people like impractical things, and I usually find things that are very impractical but entertaining. If people like practical things, then I find things that are practical but a little bit out of the ordinary. And it has to be said, usually the presents I find for people do meet with a lot of approval. So the other part of my service is that basically, if people don't want to trawl through the catalogues, I am saying, well, give me a profile. I have a questionnaire. Give me a profile and I will find a list of appropriate presents. And then email the list or send the list in some other format so that people can then make their choice from that list. Again, for a fairly small charge. I'm not wanting to make huge profits. I'm not wanting to give myself huge amounts of work. My children are still young and I want to spend time with them. But I would like to make our life somewhat easier, because at the moment we have to think very carefully before we spend any amount of money. And so I would actually, you know, just like to ease things a bit financially. Also, it's giving me something to do work-wise, and I think it's basically helping me because, you know, I can turn around to people and say, well, I'm not just sitting at home doing nothing. I am actually trying to run my own business. Now, I don't know whether this will work or not. I've no idea at all. As I say, it's literally a couple of weeks since I started making inquiries. It's in its very, very early stages. Some people are vehemently disagreeing with me because I'm charging people for catalogues. I'm charging blind people who don't have a lot of money for catalogues. But, you know, in this day and age and in this world, things aren't perfect. And I have to cover my distribution costs, my costs for internet and things like that. So that's where my charges come from. Some people are all for it. Some people are like, yes, you know, the more the merrier. Let's get access to more information. We haven't got time to scan it and we really want to read it. So I'm getting a variety of opinions. Some companies are interested, some aren't. And I just don't know how it'll work out in the long term. I guess it's a case of watch this space. My business is called Gadget Eyes, GadgetEyes. And its email address is gadgeteyes@talktalk.net. My email address is donna.slater@talktalk.net. So if you want to give me any feedback on any of this, that's great. Positive or negative, I don't mind. Feel free. People in the US, I don't really think I can help much because I'm concentrating on UK catalogues, but I thought you might be interested in what I'm doing, and maybe someone over there is doing something similar. I don't know. Right, that is by far enough on my education and career. So, now on to hobbies and my personal life and things like that. It has to be said, I have no shortage of hobbies. And they're not all very conventional either. I'm very, very fortunate in that my partner is equally keen on most things that I enjoy. So we try and fit in as much time doing hobbies as we possibly can, which is why we've actually moved back to the north of England where I was born originally, because it's more conducive to our hobbies. So what do we do? Well, we canoe. We have a Canadian canoe and we live in the Lake District, so we canoe on Lake Coniston. We have done some tidal canoeing, which was interesting. We have a sailing boat. We sail. We used to do a lot of sailing until the children were born. We don't do as much now. It's not as easy with two small children. But we do still do some sailing. And we have a mountain bike tandem. Again, before the children were born, we used to do some severely outrageous off-road biking. The people that we used to go with would be like, oh, how are you going to get a tandem down there? And we would just go for it. And it was excellent fun. Now, because we have Alex on his bike and Bethany usually on a clip bike behind the tandem, that's like a front wheel and a bike seat. It's a wheel and a bike seat, sorry, a back wheel really and a bike seat that clip onto the tandem. And she's got a pair of handlebars and a set of pedals. So it makes for quite a long bike when that's clipped on. She never pedals either, I hasten to add. She just sits there and lets us do all the pedalling. So we tend to stick to tracks through a local forest called Grisdale Forest. They're quite hilly tracks, but they're not rough. They're quite wide and they're quite pleasant biking. Or we tend to use quiet sort of country lanes which don't have much traffic. We both also really like walking, and again, before we had the children, we used to do a lot of walking. Now we're a bit more limited because the kids get fed up with the walks. You know, they'll maybe want to walk for a mile and a half, say, and then that's quite enough. They've had enough of that. Matt and Alex also do orienteering, which is where you have a map. And you have certain points that you have to get to on the map. And they're like checkpoints. And then basically the routes on this map are of varying difficulty and they are timed. And you get a time at the end of the route sort of stating how quickly you've done it and where you've come in the group that we're doing the orienteering. So they do some of that periodically. I absolutely love travelling. And I've been to quite a lot of places. I've travelled extensively throughout Europe. When I was at university, a couple of friends and I went interrailing for a month through Europe, staying in very, very cheap hotels and in youth hostels and occasionally sleeping on trains at night. It was a wonderful, wonderful way of seeing areas of Europe. We travelled through Switzerland, Spain, Italy, France, Germany. One of the best holidays I've had, actually. It was an absolutely excellent month. We met lots of people. We saw lots and lots of different sort of countries, different scenery, different ways of life. And the train journeys themselves were really good because the trains were so variable. So, for example, in Barcelona, they have a wonderful metro system which announces every single stop and is all air-conditioned. And oh, it was just lovely. In Switzerland, the trains are never, ever late. I mean, I think when we were in Switzerland the whole time we were there, there was never one late train and they're very comfortable. In Spain, well, different story. If you're travelling above ground, as it were, as opposed to on the metro in Barcelona, the trains are crowded and noisy and funny and really entertaining, to say the least. So, yeah, that was a very educational, very enjoyable holiday. Then one year, when I was working for the firm of solicitors, a friend of mine organised a canoeing expedition to Scotland. Now, Scotland is like at the extreme, it's a separate country, but it is at the extreme north of England. Scotland in Christmas time, well, it tends to be bleak, it tends to be cold, it tends to be windy, it tends to be snowy. And this friend said that he was going up to Scotland camping and he was taking a canoe, and that another couple were going up with him, and did I want to go as well? And I, because I'm mad and like doing things like that, said, yeah, okay, I'll go. So we were chatting away and he said, right, well, the other couple that are going, he said, they've been friends of mine for a long time, and the guy from the other couple doesn't like using a kayak because he gets cramp. So he's going to share the Canadian canoe with you. You'll like him, honestly. And it's like, oh God, so I'm going to go in a Canadian canoe with a complete stranger. I don't know how to canoe at all. I hadn't done any canoeing at the time. I was having second thoughts. But anyway, I sort of said, oh yeah, okay, right. Well, okay, we'll do it. So we went up to Scotland. Well, actually, the weekend before we went up to Scotland, we all met up for the first time and they decided that I needed to have a lesson in canoeing. So, Paul, the friend that I was going with, and Matthew, my now husband, but the guy that I didn't know at the time, took me to a flooded car park and decided that we could do some canoeing around this flooded car park. So Matthew and I duly got in the Canadian canoe and started canoeing, and all of a sudden I'm sort of like, aren't we canoeing through a building? And he said, yeah, well, actually we are. He said, we're just canoeing into the flooded Gents Lews. So the story is that I actually met my husband in a flooded Gents Lews in a canoe. We went up to Scotland, and Matthew and I, well, I thought he was okay, but I wasn't really that bothered because he seemed very, very quiet, didn't say much at all while we were canoeing, and seemed to really keep his distance. And basically, the actual scenario was that while we were canoeing, it was really, really windy, and I was so hopeless at canoeing at the time that he was having to canoe like mad just to keep us moving at all. So he didn't actually have any breath to talk or anything, and I think he was quite concerned that, the canoeing trip was sort of going to be a complete and utter disaster. Anyway, strangely enough, about 8 months after the canoeing trip, we met up again, and actually went walking, and really started to get on well together then, and things just went from strength to strength, and we ended up living together for a while and ultimately getting married. So, whilst I was going out with Matt, we went to Africa for a month before, well, about a year, 2 years before we got married. And we went to Zimbabwe on safari. We had an absolutely wonderful time, really, really wonderful. Some of the time we were spending in tents, really close to the animals. The nights were very sleepless because we had elephants wandering through the camp, uprooting trees. We had lions making a kill and dragging it into the toilet area to eat it. We had hyenas marauding through the camp and emptying the rubbish bins. And oh gosh, it was entertaining, scary, and whether I'd do it again now, well, I'm not sure, but I thoroughly enjoyed it at the time. Whilst in Zimbabwe, we did some whitewater rafting below Victoria Falls, and that again was absolutely entertaining, and wonderful because the locals were so thrilled that a blind person would actually have a go at something like whitewater rafting on such a dangerous stretch of river that basically I had a huge sort of group of locals just watching my every move and really, really being so supportive and so, yeah, go for it, you've got to do it. It was absolutely wonderful, really was. In fact, we had such a good time in Zimbabwe that when we got married, we went back there for our honeymoon and also went into Botswana and spent some time out safarying in Botswana in the Okavango Delta, which is like a huge reed bed where you see the animals by canoeing in dugout canoes through the reed bed, and the canoes are so silent. You can just hear all the wildlife. It's a magical, magical area. We also spent 5 days canoeing down the Zambezi River and just sleeping under mosquito nets at night time around campfires, and again, that was absolutely magical. We had hippos around us, we saw crocodiles, we saw bee eaters, we saw lions at really close range, and we did some walking on foot through the bush with a guide and actually got very, very close to a pride of lions. It was absolutely incredible, and I feel very, very privileged to have had the opportunity to go out to such a beautiful area of Africa where the locals were such wonderful people, and just to spend time with them, to spend time really close to the animals. It's something that I'll never be able to recapture, and it's something that now for Zimbabwe just seems more and more impossible. But for anyone who does get the chance to visit Africa and go on safari, I really suggest you do it. It's so worthwhile. I'm actually working on persuading Matt to read some of the extracts from the diaries he kept of our travels in Africa, because they are so evocative of the place. He's a much better wordsmith than I am. I quite go for the recording the sounds, and he'll sit and write a diary. Unfortunately, when we were in Africa, I just had a rubbishy cassette recorder, and because of all the dust and everything, the tapes broke, and I just didn't get any decent recordings at all, which is very disappointing. I should also add that while out in Africa, we took a helicopter ride over the Victoria Falls. And for anyone who's not been in a helicopter before, they are incredibly noisy. Absolutely amazingly so. Certainly the one I went in, you didn't actually feel much movement other than a lot of vibration. I mean, yeah, you sort of vaguely felt that you were lifting off and things like that, but you had no real sense of movement. It was just so very, very noisy. But again, I just wish I'd been able to record the pilot's description of the falls as we flew over them, because it was something absolutely magical. And it is so sad to see what is happening to Zimbabwe now, and to see that Victoria Falls now is just really out of the question for tourists. Okay, so what else do I do? Well, as I've said, I've got two young children, and much to everyone's surprise, I absolutely love having them. I was never a one for other people's children, and I never actually thought I would be at all maternal, but I thoroughly enjoy having my kids, and I tend to be quite an inventive parent. We'll sort of get up to all sorts of things. I'm afraid I tend to allow the house to get quite messy. We'll use Play-Doh, plasticine, paints and things, and I think other relatives despair that sometimes they'll walk into the house and there's plasticine or Play-Doh everywhere, and we're making all sorts of models and various things like that. But I'm just enjoying my kids while they're young. They'll grow up soon enough and won't want to do that sort of thing. And it gives me the chance to be childish again and play with all the toys, all the high-tech toys and everything that the kids have nowadays. I would have loved those when I was little, so I play with them now instead. I enjoy cooking. I'm not a brilliant cook. I can cook reasonably well. And if there's enough interest, maybe that's something that we could discuss, ways of cooking various things. I make my own bread. I have a bread machine, and I have a George Foreman grill, so I do quite a lot of grilling on that, and that's possibly something that we could talk about in the future as well. I could not survive without having a book to read, I don't think. I always have two or three books on the go on my book port. I've always loved reading. I used to get very frustrated by Braille because there were never enough books and I could never read quickly enough in Braille. So I love having my book port and being able to read, in quotes, at a speed that I like. I said in an earlier podcast about having a guide dog. I had Rachel, my guide dog, when I worked for the firm of solicitors and when I was down in Southampton. Rachel was an absolute character. It has to be said from the outset that I am not the sort of person who is very, very keen on animals. I don't dislike them. I don't dislike animals at all. I've always had dogs. I'm just not one who enjoys spending lots of time with animals. I'm much more of a people person. And I was very much in two minds whether to have a guide dog or not. It was one of those things,
would I be good enough at looking after the guide dog, etc., etc. And I was, I have to say, I was quite dubious. And I spoke to a lot of people about it and to the guide dog centre and explained how I felt. But I also said that if the guide dog was of huge benefit to me, then I would be prepared to put in the work necessary to make the guide dog really want to work for me. Because the thing about having a guide dog is that it's a balance. A guide dog will only work well for you if you make it worth its while. Basically, if you don't give the dog enough attention, enough praise, then the dog isn't going to work that well for you. Now, I'm not saying that there are dogs who just don't work well anyway. I'm not saying that at all. But I am saying, by and large, if you have a guide dog, basically, it is very much a balance. So I'd said to the guide dog centre, well, you know, that's my position. I'm not really one for spending loads and loads and loads of time with a dog. I don't feel I need one that really needs a lot of attention. I mean, I understand any animal needs some attention. So, with that in mind, I arrived at the guide dog training centre and eventually was duly introduced to my guide dog, Rachel. Rachel was a lab who was absolutely hyper. While all the other guide dog owners or guide dog trainees had dogs that were sort of quite calm and, you know, would be fairly quiet, Rachel, given half a chance, would be jumping up and sitting on my knee and licking me and bouncing about everywhere. And oh, she was absolutely hyper. She really was. I'm a fast walker, and at her speed, I really had to sort of walk very fast to keep up. Anyway, training went well with Rachel. She was quite innovative, quite bright, and quite characterful. If she made a decision, she would really want to go with that decision, and it was quite often difficult to dissuade her. When I returned home with her, I decided that I really didn't want to share a room with her, and we decided, I was living with my parents at the time, we decided that she could live in the living room, she could sleep in the living room. Well, that would have been fine, except that we discovered Rachel did not like being on her own. And if she was on her own, she would find something to chew. Now, my mum has a very nice collection of cookery books. Or it was very nice. It's now modified. And the first morning after I got home, I got up and went to let Rachel out, and there's paper all over the living room floor. And I'm thinking, what has she been doing? Where's that come from? She had eaten all the bindings, chewed up all the bindings off my mum's cookery books. She must have spent, well, a lot of the night doing so. So that really didn't endear her very much to my parents initially, although, to be perfectly honest, she was such a lovable dog that no one could stay really annoyed with her for long. She did not like repetition. She did not like boring routes. And if she thought a route was boring, she would either not concentrate or she would try and vary it. And if I wasn't concentrating, that could be interesting. I used to have quite a walk to work every day. And it was quite a complicated route, but not very challenging for her. And so where she could, she would try and vary it. Well, one day, I got all dressed up to go to court because I was representing a client in court. So I was in my smart suit and really looking, you know, quite smart with my briefcase in my hand and on my way to work. And we're walking down a street, and I'm quite confident because I know the area well, so we're walking fairly quickly. The next thing, I disappear down a manhole cover, a drain cover. I don't know, again, the US terminology for this, but a hatchway in the pavement, in the sidewalk, leading down to the drains. And I am up to my thighs in sludgy, disgusting, mucky, well, raw sewage, I guess, really. It wasn't very pleasant. As you can imagine, I wasn't very happy. So I'm clambering out of the hole, basically telling Rachel that I am not happy. Not shouting at the top of my voice, because I'm not really one to do that, and I don't like to attract attention to myself, and so I'm just sort of talking in quite a vehement voice to her, telling her that I'm really not happy, and, you know, that basically I'm in quite a mess, and I'm also saying something to the effect of I'm not happy that the hole was left unprotected. Well, unknown to me, I'd been followed down the street by a lady who, once I climbed out of the hole, basically came up to me, and I was expecting her to say, "Are you all right?" And she said, "I'd like your name and address, please." And I said, "Oh, okay. Why, you know, why do you need that?" "I need to report you to the guide dog centre. That guide dog wouldn't have led you into that hole. You must have fallen down it deliberately. And how dare you call your dog names?" And I just stood there for a minute and then just calmly gave her my name and address. I just thought, oh, well, you know, I just don't believe this. I'm standing here dripping muddy, yucky gunk, and she's asking me for my name and address to report me to the guide dog centre. So, anyway, I had to actually go back home and get changed before I returned to work. So that was one incident. Another incident was one which occurred when I was actually standing in the job centre. Basically, I had a client who was unable to fill in some rather complex forms, and I'd gone to the job centre to fill them in with her. And we were standing in a massive queue, and I was chatting to my client, and I had Rachel's lead looped round my wrist, and I suppose wasn't paying as much attention to her as I should have done. And the next thing, this lady taps my arm and said, "Well, your dog really likes sausages, doesn't she?" I was horrified. I'm so sorry. Oh gosh, I haven't been concentrating. Really, how much do I owe you for these sausages? "Oh, it's all right," she said. "She's only eaten two. I've taken the others off her. I'll cook them for my tea." Oh, I was like, oh gosh, look, just let me pay you out, you know, and you can get yourself some more sausages. You needn't have the ones that my dog's been, you know, trying to eat. "No, no," she said, "it's absolutely fine." So, yes, I was rather embarrassed by that one. And just one final incident. I was getting off a train, returning home from work one time, and Rachel very vehemently decided that she wanted to turn the opposite way to our usual way. Now, I knew that that way just led down the train track. There's literally no more to the station. There's no streets, nothing, just the train track, which I would have had to have walked down the side of. So I refused to go that way and basically kept repeating the direction I wanted. And telling her that, you know, we were definitely going that way, and she more or less refused to move. So I was standing next to her saying that I wanted to go one way, she wanted to go the other way. In the end, very reluctantly, I put the harness down and I moved very slightly away from her to feel carefully if there was anything in the way to stop her, you know, from going that way. Found that there was nothing in the way. So I basically started encouraging her with the lead to go in the direction that I wanted. All of a sudden, a man appeared by my side and basically berated me hugely for calling my guide dog a stupid dog, because he said, you know, they're really intelligent, and if she wants to go that way, that's the way you should be going. And I sort of said, well, is there anything actually blocking my way if I, you know, go my usual way? And if I go the other way, I'm just going to go down the train track. No, but she's obviously got a reason for wanting to go that way, so you should go with her. Well, oh, honestly, I mean, it's absolutely amazing. And there's the old story that people tell the guide dog directions and things like that. Well, yeah, I've really had that happen. I have really had people tell my dog directions when I've asked for directions. When I'd first started going out with Matt, we'd gone swimming one day and we'd left Rachel in Matt's parents' house. Matt's parents were on holiday. We were only away a short time. And I didn't think that there would be any problem. We returned to his parents' house and opened the outer door to their kitchen. They have like a porch which has an outer door. You go in through the porch and then you come to the actual main kitchen door. And I opened the outer door and could hear Rachel getting very, very, very excited and sounding very loud. And Matt came in with me and basically he just stood there and collapsed laughing because Rachel had enlarged their cat flap into a dog flap and was in the process of crawling through it. She had eaten her way through the door surrounding the cat flap. And she did manage to crawl through it and she managed to present us with a large piece of door which she chewed. Well, I didn't know Matt's parents well, and so I was really, really upset, absolutely mortified, didn't know what to do. We spent the whole weekend basically up to our elbows in wood filler and paint trying to repair the damage. And his parents came back off holiday and I immediately phoned them, very, very apologetic. And all I could hear was them laughing and laughing and laughing in the background. And they were just so amused by the fact that, you know, a guide dog who is meant to be so wonderful, so intelligent, so whatever, had just sort of caused all this havoc in their house. And they just really saw the funny side of it. And they also thought it was so funny that I was really worried about what she'd done. That certainly didn't put them off Rachel, because when she retired, she actually lived with them for 3 years nearly. So, yeah, they certainly didn't take that too hard, luckily. She was definitely a character. We were all very, very fond of her. Very fond of her. I did have another short spell with a guide dog, but that didn't work out because of the house where we were living and because I had Alex, who was very young at the time, and Alex and Fallon didn't seem to get on, and it didn't work at all. So I reverted back to using my cane, and I quite frankly find that okay for my needs at the moment. I don't know if circumstances change, I might think about a dog in the future, but I've always said that as soon as someone invents a guide robot, I'll have one. Right, well, I think that really is enough waffle from me for the time being. If there are any areas that anyone wants me to chat about more, particularly from a UK sort of standpoint, whether it be my education, things that I've done, places I've been or whatever, then please feel free to let me know. As I said earlier, my email address is Donna, Donna, Slater, at talktalk.net. And thanks again, Larry, for allowing me to do this. Okay, bye for now.